I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks to you, we've reached a milestone. The first time in our nation's history that a woman will be a major party's nominee.
That was Hillary Clinton speaking last night in Brooklyn after winning primaries in New Jersey, South Dakota, and New Mexico. And this morning she won the California primary, less than 100 years after women got the right to vote. She congratulated Sanders for an extraordinary campaign that was both good for the party and the country. Sanders, who won North Dakota and Montana yesterday, said he wasn't done and would fight for every vote and every delegate.
And then we take our fight for social, economic, racial, and environmental justice to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
President Obama reportedly told the candidates they ran inspiring campaigns, and he's meeting with Sanders tomorrow. Donald Trump had a sweep of victories yesterday after a challenging week for members of Congress who support his campaign, rejecting his racially charged comments about a judge presiding over a Trump University lawsuit. Well, here to talk about all of this is Ross Baker, distinguished professor of political science at Rutgers University, the author of several books, including one called Is Bipartisanship Dead? Apparently, we lost Ross Baker. We will call him right back. But we do have Joe Garofoli joining us, and he's senior political writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. And Joe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, let me begin with California. Of course, it wasn't on East Coast time until early this morning that the results came in. Just how close was the race for Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton in California?
Well, that was the big surprise. All the major polls had this as a statistical dead heat as of a couple of days ago. So it was very surprising that Secretary Clinton finished with 56% of the vote. Senator Sanders got about 43%. So that was the margin of victory that was rather surprising here.
Would it be fair to say, and we'll get Ross Baker in on the conversation, she has done well with minority voters, with older voters, with women voters. Was that true in California, Joe?
Well, it's almost like a generational split. If you're about 40 to 45 or younger, regardless, almost across the board, you were with Sanders. If you were older than that, you're with Clinton. And that held true here from what we're seeing. The challenge was there's a lot of, because California for the first time in generations counted, people were like, oh my gosh,
that's
California,
right.
Our votes are actually going to count. Usually we're an afterthought despite being the largest state, the most populous state. So there was a surge of voter registration over the last several months, particularly in the last several weeks. But many of those voters were younger folks.
Right.
However, it's believed that many of them did not actually turn out to vote because younger voters generally don't vote in primaries. Regardless of the excitement level, they're general election voters.
Well, Joe, and just to underscore what you just said, I heard that one in eight Americans lives in California.
That is true. And most of those people have not seen participated in a meaningful primary election for much of their lifetime.
Ross Baker, let me get you in on the conversation, and thanks for joining us once again on Radio Time. Sorry, we lost the connection just as I was welcoming you to the show.
Good morning, Marty.
So what do you make of Hillary Clinton's win, and certainly comparing to what happened 8 years ago when she lost to Barack Obama? How do you think she did it, Ross?
Well, she is a very persistent, focused person. And this was something she knew immediately after her defeat in 2008 that she was going to have to do. And it was a little bit like having failed to reach the summit of Mount Everest, she went back to the base camp, packed her tent and her oxygen, and started up the hill again.
Well, she is dogged, is she not?
That she is. And it's a real tribute to her fortitude. She, in many ways, is an indestructible person, and that's really one of her virtues.
How did she do in New Jersey yesterday, Ross?
Pretty good, I'd say. 63.3% as opposed to Bernie Sanders' 36.7%, practically 2-1. And it was predicted. New Jersey, I don't think, was really ever in doubt. But there is something kind of interesting about New Jersey, Marty. I think I had sort of called your listeners' attention to.
Sure.
Hillary Clinton got the endorsement of all 21 county Democratic chairs. And she won, in fact, 19 of New Jersey's 21 counties. And the two that she lost were Sussex and Warren. And these are New Jersey's two most conservative counties, and they went for Bernie Sanders. And I think it may tell us something about disaffected Sanders voters. And, you know, there's a kind of protest community that exists in every American presidential election that always feels that the cards are stacked against the outsiders, that the establishment controls the events, and so on, and are prepared to defect in peculiar ways to the other party. This happened, for example, way back in 1968, when about 18% of Eugene McCarthy voters ended up voting for George Wallace.
Wow. So, that's a kind of a protest vote.
Yes, exactly. And it's been a kind of constant in American politics. And I think it's a problem that Hillary Clinton is going to have to deal with. We don't know how large that group is. I suspect that most Sanders followers will ultimately become reconciled to Clinton being the standard bearer. But there's always that group that really feels that they've been hard done by.
Well, Joe, let me get you back in on the conversation and picking up on what Ross Baker was just saying there. As you said, there was and it's been pretty typical this primary season to see the split among Democratic or in some cases independent voters and how they both viewed Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. What did Bernie Sanders say? Was it early this morning, I guess, when he was talking to his voters?
Yes, he said, late in the evening here, he said the struggle will continue. He said we're going to go to campaign in the primary in Washington, D.C. next week, which the demographics there are not favorable to him, and we're going to take this all the way to the convention. He said the struggle will continue, which, you know, is at the core of this. He said this is not about, and this is a line he's repeated on the trail many times, this is not about Bernie Sanders. This is not even about primarily about defeating Donald Trump. This is about changing our political system so it's not overly influenced by the wealthiest interests in our country. So this is he's looking at a big picture. This is beyond the politics of the day for him. Something interesting to note, though, out here is, you know, we have all this tumult about, oh, my God, are the Sanders people going to come over to Clinton? Would the Clinton people go to the Sanders? One of the surveys we saw out here in California was that 75% of Sanders supporters said they would ultimately support Clinton in a general election. 85% of Clinton supporters would have said they would have supported Sanders. So that's something to keep in mind. Well, you know, there's going to be a lot of tears in the next few days and weeks. Ultimately, three of four of these folks are likely to come along for the ride.
Ross, going back to you and picking up what Joe said and also acknowledging what Hillary Clinton said last night, which is that it's painful to lose. She says, I know that. I have been through this 8 years ago. Took her a couple of days to kind of get herself together to be able to acknowledge that Barack Obama at least won in the delegate count. This is painful stuff for a candidate to lose such a hard-fought race.
It certainly is, and I think we've really got to take a very close look at the personality of Bernie Sanders. I spent the last 4 months down in Washington, D.C., in Senator Harry Reid's office, and was curious about Sanders as a senator, what he was like, how he interacted with other senators. And principally, Sanders is very much a loner. And from what I heard from staff people and from a couple of senators, a very difficult man to work with. He was a man on a mission, always has been. Always felt in some ways that he had a kind of divine mission to basically carry the doctrines that he believes in. And he is a very doctrinaire person. He's very irascible. He is very, in some ways, very dogmatic and very rigid. And I think you're seeing this in his desire to kind of fight to the bitter end. And I think he feels that somehow he's trying to get a kind of vindication, and he won't really let up until it's made very clear to him that there's no possible way that he can get the nomination. I mean, he came in, after all, knowing about the superdelegates. It was not as if this was something that was pulled on him at the last minute, and he criticized the rules of the game. Well, you don't get into the game if you don't like the rules of the game. And I think this is really one of his very, very considerable shortcomings.
And yet, Joe, you know, we see these rallies. You certainly had them in California. The way he connects with his supporters, with the people that voted for him or thought about voting for him, it's such an interesting, almost like a contrast.
Oh, yeah. He did, over the last several weeks, he did 38 events in 34 cities in California. He drew well more than 230,000 people to these events, and most of these are, you know, 2, 3, 5, 10,000 at a crack.
Right.
There's definitely a huge amount of energy there, and it's not just young people. There's also a lot of older people who've been around and want to change the system. And so where do they go now? He needs to give some sort of what's the next step other than, okay, we're going to Philadelphia. So then, well, what do we want there? That's what I think Sanders has to do now, is sort of explain, give the rest of the roadmap. We're out of primaries except for D.C. Now, what should his folks be doing now? That's what he needs to spell out to have this become an effective movement. He talks about it being a movement a lot. Even the people who work for him, I did something in the story the other day saying, this movement is not necessarily about Bernie Sanders. He was kind of the right guy at the right time.
Mm.
And so now what? That's the question.
Russ, about a minute before our first break here, but I mean, he certainly can influence the party platform here in Philadelphia when the convention comes to town. It seems to me that even if he hasn't won, he still has some clout.
Oh,
he definitely has clout, and this is peak clout for Bernie Sanders right now. The next few days, when he talks to the president on Thursday,
right,
when he talks to Harry Reid, this is the time for him to spell out what he wants and conduct those negotiations, because the mainline Democrats want this to go away fast, and he doesn't. He wants to make sure he gets every ounce of the lemon that he got.
Well, you know what, Russ, I know you want to answer that as well. The clock is telling me we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Joe Garofoli's senior political writer at the San Francisco Chronicle, talking about yesterday's primary in California, where Hillary Clinton was able to defeat Bernie Sanders. Also with us, Ross Baker, distinguished professor of political science at Rutgers University, the author of several books about politics, including Is Bipartisanship Dead? 1-888-477-9499 to join the conversation. What do you make of the race so far? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Ross Baker and Joe Garofoli about the race for the White House, the historic win by Hillary Clinton. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Ross, I know you wanted to talk about the kind of influence that Bernie Sanders can bring to the convention here in Philadelphia.
Well, yes. I mean, I think that certainly the Clinton people and the party establishment recognize that he has a following. He's gotten people appointed to the platform committee, some of whom are clearly quite controversial people. But I think that certainly the Clinton people and the party organizations are definitely going to try to keep the Sanders people on a very short leash. There'll be some symbolic payoffs. But I really do think that the influence of Sanders is going to be very limited.
Who are some of those controversial people?
Well, Cornel West, for one, an academic colleague formerly from Princeton University, is one of them. Jane Zogby, a Arab American activist, and so on, are people who I think are a real problem for strong supporters of Israel, for example.
Joe, let me go back to you. And I know there was also a race in California to replace Barbara Boxer, retiring senator, longtime senator from California. Where does that stand?
Well, that's an interesting development because for the first time, we're going to have two Democrats facing off in a general election, two female Democrats, that is. And one of them is our sitting State Attorney General Kamala Harris, and the other is Representative Loretta Sanchez from Anaheim in Southern California. And the reason that is because in California, the top two vote-getters in the primary, regardless of party, go on to the general election the fall. This is a statement on the weakness of the Republican Party in California. It's virtually non-existent. And so Kamala Harris got 40% of the vote, whereas Sanchez got about 18%, and the next Republicans were like in 10 and below percent. So it's a very unusual step. This is the first we've seen this in California.
Speaking of Republicans, how did Donald Trump do in California?
Donald Trump got about 77% of the vote here, which the significance of that is, of course, everybody else has suspended or ended their campaign. Is that 4 years ago, Mitt Romney, facing sort of similar circumstances, the rest of his opposition had dropped out or had sort of slowed down their campaigns, got 80%. Certainly, there is a lot of consolidation around Trump here, but he did not, he didn't quite reach the standard that Romney hit four years ago, which I'm sure, given his the animosity between the two, doesn't sit well with either of them, or at least with Trump.
Ross, last week and also last night, Hillary Clinton basically said that Donald Trump is unfit to be president of the United States. She is not mincing her words in her criticism of the Republican nominee.
Well, I think she feels that she can really jerk his chain on this particular thing, which is that he's emotionally and temperamentally unfit to be president, as demonstrated by some of the statements that he's made. And that's a rather devastating attack on an opponent. Usually these campaigns are fought over things like policy issues and so on. And probably not since 1964 has the personality of the candidate and the person's emotional fitness to be president of the United States been a major theme, major attack theme on the part of the other candidate. And I think that is certainly going to be a sustained message that Clinton's going to use throughout the campaign.
And Donald Trump said last night that he's going to deliver a speech sometime next week about the Clintons, I guess, both Bill and Hillary Clinton. So, Ross, this is what we're going to be hearing for the next couple of months.
Well, that's right. It's sort of the Clintons' political baggage versus Donald Trump's emotional baggage.
Or business baggage.
And I think, in terms of, his being kind of an unstable person, being somebody who is, given to outbursts and given to indiscreet comments and things like that. So, I think it portends a highly negative campaign. I just don't see any way that this is ever going to become one of the more high-minded presidential campaigns.
What do you see as you look into your crystal ball, Joe?
Well, I'm very curious about his attack that he sort of previewed last night about the Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and Bill Clinton running the State Department as their own private hedge fund, as he put it.
Yes.
Which essentially he's alleging that they're trading access with world leaders and from the Soviet Union and China. This is going to be a very tough thing for the Clintons to shrug off. And because it goes right to the trust issue, which has been dogging her the whole campaign. Many voters do not find her trustworthy. For as many of the negatives as Trump has, Clinton has nearly as many.
Well, go ahead, Ross.
One of the things I point out is that I it's still very, very, very unclear to me why Clinton hasn't released the text of her Goldman Sachs speeches. I've not heard a satisfactory explanation of why those speeches can't be made public. And I think that's something that Trump's going to go after.
Well, and I wondered too, Ross, if there's any more about her server, her use of emails. Certainly the FBI is looking into this. And I guess that's an ongoing question that she's going to have to deal with.
Right, and I think that, you know, that one of the things that Trump has used in the past is, as of course, Hillary Clinton, as Bill Clinton's enabler in terms of his relationship with women. And I think we're going to hear more about that as well.
That's Ross Baker, distinguished professor of political science at Rutgers University. Joe Garofoli, also joining us as well, senior political writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. And about 10 minutes or so, we'll be joined by Rebecca Traister, who has a pretty interesting piece, a story about Hillary Clinton in New York Magazine. In the meantime, let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Ross, just a website comment from Beth says, Hillary has displayed grit, a current buzzword in education circles. Do you agree with that?
very much so. I think grit sums it up very well. I think she has overcome a lot of obstacles that might have even been fatal to other candidates. That second acts are not common in American politics, and especially second acts that end successfully. And I think this was something that really is an element in her character, which is this tenacity and this ability to pursue a goal single-mindedly and with a tremendous amount of ability to weather the most savage attacks.
Joe, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I agree that there is a certain amount of grit and determination in the Secretary Clinton, but she also has the advantage of, 3 decades of being in the mainstream, her 100% name recognition, a bottomless list of fundraisers. She didn't have to worry about, she's doing a lot of fundraisers, but she didn't have to. She came in with a lot of advantages too, built by the dint of hard work and such. So there is definitely some advantages she had over the field. She essentially cleared the field, except for, you know, a guy who's a socialist from Vermont and a governor from Maryland who disappeared rather quickly. So I mean, there people
don't
were
afraid
by
Jim Webb,
power.
Joe.
What's that, Ross?
I was reminding Joe about Jim Webb.
Oh, and Jim Webb is right.
Oh, Jim Webb, yes, of course. How can we forget Jim? He had a marvelous 3 weeks. Yes.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you, Joe Garofoli and Ross Baker, joining us to talk about the race for the White House, last night's results, the fact that Hillary Clinton is claiming that she has won all the votes and delegate votes and popular vote to be the Democratic nominee. Of course, Bernie Sanders saying that he is not done yet. He's going to take the fight to Philadelphia, where the Democrats meet in July. Let me get Keita from Chad's Ford to join us. Keita, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have two comments. One is that I heard a quote one time saying, never trust a man with principles, for sooner or later he will sacrifice you to them. And that kind of sounds like Bernie Sanders. The other comment I have to make is that I heard personally from someone who worked with Hillary Clinton in the State Department, a young woman who worked with her, and said she was a wonderful person to work for. She really listened to people, and she really cared about people. And I'm wondering if some of the static about her is a lot of misogyny. Comments, please.
All right, Keita, thanks for calling into Radio Times. I don't have a problem with men with principles. I just want to say that. Joe, do you want to respond to Keita? And some others have said, you know, that sexism has dogged this, and perhaps misogyny has dogged Hillary Clinton for now decades.
Oh, and no doubt, there's some element of that. I think there were, 8 years ago, we were wondering, oh my gosh, will America ever elect an African American man? And then the question was answered twice, and now we have this question: will America elect a woman to be president? And so I think the political cliche goes, the voters will ultimately decide this, and I think that will be one of the most interesting things on there, and watching how this develops, because Trump is going to start saying, she's playing the woman card. And how are people going to react to that? I mean, how many times can he say that, and what's the reaction going to be? And that's going to be one of the most fascinating things to watch in this race.
Ross, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's not as simple as the fact that there's opposition to women, because, you know, Hillary Clinton is entangled with all of these other Clinton negatives, Whitewater and the speeches on Wall Street and the server and Huma Abedin, her principal aide, and so on. It's kind of hard to disentangle her as a woman from these other sort of Clinton-affiliated barnacles that are on her hull.
Let me get Dan from Mount Airy to join our conversation. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you. I just want to follow up on Ross's comment about the platform committee and that they'll hold Bernie Sanders on a tight leash. I think that one, he's right, but that would be a mistake. In fact, given all the barnacles that he was just mentioning in Hillary Clinton, the one place where she has an opportunity to build trust and show that she cares about working people and try to get her trust numbers up is trying to find common ground around the platform, particularly on economic issues.
You know what, Dan? I'm going to jump in here only because we have a really bad phone line, and I'm afraid that our listeners and perhaps even our guests can't really understand what you're saying. But I'm looking at the computer here, wondering how Hillary Clinton will be able to unite the party. And this isn't as much as Bernie's issues as hers now. Ross, do you agree with that, that it's really her job to win over his supporters?
I think it always is. I think there's a certain amount of stroking that needs to go on, but not an excessive amount. I mean, I think he deserves a certain amount of deference for what he did, and you know, he won a lot of states, mostly low population states, caucus states, with a few exceptions. But I think that there has to be an end to that. I think, you look at the numbers, and the numbers, both pledged and unpledged delegates, really suggest that Clinton is the nominee. And I think it's an indication of perhaps the unrealistic notion that Sanders himself has of his chances, that he is going to contest this in the District of Columbia, which I think is the least auspicious place for him to run. Which has a very large African-American population, which has overwhelmingly favored Hillary Clinton. And of the non-African-American population, I think you've got a community of pragmatists who really want a winner, and I think are very realistic about the chances of her defeating Trump even more than Bernie Sanders' chances.
Let me see what Nick from Fishtown has to say. Nick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to discuss one of the comments that the gentleman made earlier, that, you know, one of Bernie Sanders' shortcomings is, you know, staying in this race, even though he knows that, you know, the system, the rules are against him and whatnot. I just want to make two comments about that. First, you know, I don't see a better platform to kind of expose these issues. And I think if his ultimate goal is to kind of expose the system, you know, unbreak what is broken, I think that that's the best platform to do it on. And also, you know, with today's media, you know, things come and go within 24 hours and people forget them. And, you know, by staying in the race and making news every day, he's better able to inform a larger mass and to, you know, keep people informed of, you know, what's going on and why he feels the way he does.
Fair enough. No, thanks, Nick, for calling into Radio Times. Joe, do you want to take that?
I think that's an excellent point. You know, we wouldn't be talking, it wouldn't be so much part of our lexicon that the system is quote unquote rigged. And that we're talking about these issues, but we're talking so much about income inequality that we even had a start of a conversation about free college tuition, which would have seemed crazy several months ago. That we're talking about Medicare for all, that these issues that Senator Sanders brought to the campaign are having a public airing. Is testament to the support that he did generate and the community of supporters that he had. Now, ultimately, it doesn't look like he's going to be successful with it. But I mean, he, by staying in the race, by generating this conversation, he definitely has influenced where America is on these issues. And let's face it, his followers are the future of the Democratic Party. Many of them will be, and many of them, you know, will peel off and do other stuff. But that's, I think, it is an important thing that he did for the Democrats.
Ross, do you think he made Hillary Clinton not just a better candidate, perhaps, but a more liberal/progressive candidate?
Oh, unquestionably. Look, I think that she probably would have loved not to have had any serious competition and cruised to the nomination. But I think it was really basic training for her again, or if she needed it after 2008. But the fact is that if you have spirited competition, if you have someone running against you who tests you all the time, and someone whose ideas are appealing, certainly she has been forced to move farther to the left on a number of issues. I think particularly on economic issues, particularly on the dominant position that the 0.1% has on the economy of the United States. I mean, that is clear, and I think that the numbers are clearly so obvious to people at this point. And I'm just not sure she would have emphasized income inequality had it not been for Bernie Sanders. But I think that's a concern on the part of on the minds of a lot of voters.
Joe, I'm going to give you the last word.
The best description of what the next several months are going to be like, I've heard from a top Democratic strategist, is like a 49-45 football game. There's going to be a lot of turnovers, a lot of mistakes. It's going to be very exciting. It's going to be ugly. And ultimately, one team late in the game is going to win.
One team that you're not going to name.
this person was a Democratic strategist, and he said that Hillary Clinton will win in the end.
Well, we will find out in November. Joe Garofoli, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.
Fun for us as well. Senior political writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. Ross Baker, as always, thank you for joining us, too.
Thanks very much, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. We have Rebecca Traister waiting in the wings. We'll be talking more about the race and focusing on Hillary Clinton. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Hillary Clinton has made history as the first woman to be the presumptive presidential nominee for a major political party. Last night, she paid homage to the women from another generation who had fought for equal rights, including the right to vote.
Tonight's victory is not about one person. It belongs to generations of women and men who struggled and sacrificed and made this moment possible. In our country, it started right here in New York, a place called Seneca Falls in 1848.
We asked Rebecca Traister to join us. She interviewed Hillary Clinton for New York Magazine in a story titled Hillary Clinton Versus Herself. Rebecca is a writer-at-large for New York Magazine and a contributing writer for Elle, and was recently on Radio Times talking about her most recent book, All the Single Ladies. I should also add that she wrote a book called Big Girls Don't Cry. And Rebecca, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
I'm happy to be here, Marty.
You know, I have to say Hillary Clinton really played the woman card last night. Does that surprise you?
Well, it doesn't surprise. I mean, here's what's interesting. She played it all, putting herself in the historical context of the fight for greater opportunity is something that she did in 2008 only effectively in her defeat. So, funnily enough, last night was the 8th anniversary of her very famous concession speech.
Yes.
The one in which she talked about 18 million cracks in the glass ceiling. And that speech, which is one of the rhetorical highlights of her career, was the first time after that whole slog of a 2008 campaign when she was so ambivalent and was being coached in lots of different ways about perhaps not playing the women card, and it was very hard for her to do so, and it was awkward, and she didn't do it well. Finally, in her moment of defeat, she placed herself, she felt sort of safe enough or was urged to place herself in this history and talked about, you know, women circling the earth in space, and if we can put women into space, we can launch one into the White House, and really talked in big terms about that. But that was when she was not in the race. And she did it again in her convention speech in 2008 when she was endorsing Obama, and she talked about Harriet Tubman. This was the first big example in which I heard her unapologetically say, this is history and I'm in the process of trying to make it. And so I think that's a real difference, because she is still in the race and she is finding a way to talk about herself as a historic and important figure. It's a very hard note for her to strike. Donald Trump helps her because he gives her a foil. When she just talks about herself and her own historical import, people rear back from it. So she's walking a fine line, but I think she did it pretty well last night.
You describe an almost jarring difference between the private Hillary, the one that you saw talking to small groups of people or to a woman who was, you know, struggling with her life, and the Hillary Clinton who gives speeches. Describe that dichotomy, really, the two faces of Hillary Clinton.
Well, I mean, I think that there are a lot of explanations for it. It's something I'd heard for years. I wrote a book that was largely about Hillary. I've written thousands and thousands of pieces about Hillary Clinton as a candidate, as a politician, as a historical figure. I'd never really spent time with her as a reporter. I'd never gotten closer. I'd made plenty of requests as a reporter to interview her, but hadn't ever been permitted in as a reporter. But I'd heard it. You know, oh, the Hillary we know. There was a whole campaign around the Hillary we know in 2008. Hillary is hilarious friend, is hard-drinking badass who we love and is funny and warm. And, you know, then there's the Hillary who gives the big speeches, who is often regarded, and not without reason, as a stilted speaker, as an awkward campaigner, sort of hitting the right notes, talking too loud, which, you know, has a lot of baggage attached
sure.
to it. But then when I finally, you know, got access as a reporter and spent time with her, it wasn't even just the one-on-one personal stuff, which turned out to be just so true, how warm and, you know, personable and charming. And it was also her ability as a campaigner just in smaller settings. So it was how she talked to people on the trail one-on-one. It wasn't simply a dichotomy between Hillary and her buddies, her friends, her family versus Hillary and the rest of the world. It was about her in a small setting, these round tables that she does where she talks to about 12 to 20 women and men about their experiences, about policy positions, where she does the retail politics of meeting, you know, local supporters, shaking hands, talking to people, addressing their issues. She's really, really a talented politician in that regard. So part of it is that there's this big stage issue, which giving the big soaring speech remains a serious challenge for her. It doesn't come across on television. The past two speeches she's given this week, the foreign policy one aimed at Trump and then last night, I think have been some of her best, maybe because she's trying to modulate her tone so that it's as if she's speaking to a smaller audience, mm-hmm. even though she's in front of a giant one. There's also the fact that she has, over her decades in public life, built up an enormous wall of privacy. I mean, there's a reason that I've written about Hillary Clinton for more than a decade and have only now gotten an interview with her. It's because she doesn't let the press in. She is very wary of the press and the treatment she's going to receive by the press. But that means that she remains, you don't have a lot of reporters who have access to her, who can describe the good things about her, and they're left with very little to work with except the big projected version of Hillary, which often isn't a very appealing or graceful one when you're talking about politics, and a press corps that's frustrated by not having access to her, to their subject.
Well, I found that
there are a bunch of structural challenges.
Sure, and I found that interesting in your piece. As you say, she hates the press, and mm-hmm. clearly when you're running for president, you're going to be trailed by the press. And I was thinking mm-hmm. of John McCain and how when he was running for president, you know, had the Straight Talk Express and was wooing journalists and in some cases having them eat out of his hand. Do you think she can get over her mistrust of the press and use them to her benefit, if I can put it that way?
I mean, I think she has to. I did notice this week, you know, there's been this long complaint about how long it had been since she'd given a press conference. This week she did answer questions. She did seem to relax slightly in the past week with the press. You know, I think she must get over it. And it's hard. I put in the piece, you know, this question of how do you convince her to sort of trust this press corps a little bit more, that they're not going to mistreat her, when the fact is she has had decades of, you know, very tough to unfair coverage, depending on your point of view. She's had her personal life raked over. She's been sort of linked to every possible and often imagined scandal, you know, in the political and personal universe. And so but I don't think there's a way to campaign today, especially given the new technological media, social media, the way the press now works. It's not just a couple of organs. It's not just the New York Times and the Washington Post. You now have this incredibly diverse array of outlets providing people their information. She has to get better at talking to more people more easily and being herself, whatever that means,
yeah.
being easy and relaxed with reporters if she wants America to get to know her better. I think she has to do that.
Who would tell her that, or who would say, look, Hillary, you're running for this gigantic stage, the most powerful person in the world. You're going to have to talk to the press. You're going to have press conferences. You're going to have to sit down. I mean, she has sat down for some interviews, but nonetheless, you got to get over this somehow.
Yeah, well, there are people. I mean, I'm sure people are telling her this. It's not a secret. This is not, it was not breaking news in my piece that Hillary Clinton is bad to the press. So there are people. I mean, she has a very large communication staff whose job it is to deal with the press. And they certainly, this isn't news to them either, that she's reticent about talking to the press. And, I'm sure that there are a lot of, as I said, I noted this week that she was a little bit more available, a little looser. I think there is a possibility, and I get to this in my piece. I can't predict the future. But one thing that is true is we've never seen her as a general election candidate before. And so the times we've seen her on a presidential stage have been in these primaries against these really admirable, exciting men, Barack Obama in 2008 and Bernie Sanders in 2016, men with great politics, men who nobody wants anyone to be mean to. Right. And we know that her every aggressive gesture, and this has to do with her gender and it has to do with who she is, Clinton's every aggressive gesture is read as more monstrous than it might be had it were coming from a guy or a different politician. And she hasn't really been able to fight these guys, these very nice, inspiring men with good politics. Her natural base, the left, has been divided in its support both times. She hasn't been the natural good guy in either one of those contests. But as she moves into the general election against Donald Trump, she's going to have an experience that she hasn't yet had on a presidential stage of being the good guy on her side of politics, right? And it may be, I maybe saw that in both speeches this past week, and this is part of what I wrote about in the piece. She's eager to run against Donald Trump. I think she's eager for this next phase that we haven't yet witnessed. And it could be that that helps her relax with the press, too. Feeling more confident about being the hero and not the villain in the situation.
As you write in this piece, and Donald Trump in many ways is her very opposite. You had interviewed Samantha Bee, who said that Hillary Clinton is like a working dog. You have to give her a job. And she, she does her homework. She's a good Girl Scout. She does what she's supposed to do. And in many ways, Donald Trump is, a guy that talks off the top of his head.
Yeah, they could not be more different. Hillary is, if anything, over-careful. He is completely careless. She is over-prepared. He is unprepared. She is, she worries about her weaknesses. He, just charges forward with, braying about his weaknesses. And then, of course, there's what they represent. And of course, they're only individuals. Their representative powers are slim, but they, on this heightened, exaggerated screen, here's Hillary Clinton, the first woman nominated by a major party for the presidency in 240 years, an extraordinary figure. It's amazing that this has happened. And she's coming on the heels of our first African-American president. These past 8 years, perhaps extending to 12 years, 16 years, are a remarkable time in the story of our representational history and our move toward correcting longstanding inequality. Then you have Donald Trump, who is not only sort of himself representative of so much that is white, male, and angry in this country, but is channeling the support of so many in this country who are angry about the increased inclusion and power of people of color and women, represented by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. In these limited single-person forums. So it sets up this enormous contrast. And she was very smart last night in her speech. She'd been playing with the Make America Great Trump line, and last night she said what he really means is take America backward. And that was exactly the right point to make. Donald Trump represents forces that want to go backwards in time to a period when only certain kinds of people, white men, had certain kinds of power, including the power of the presidency. Hillary Clinton represents alongside Barack Obama, represent a massive shattering shift in that power pattern.
You also say, and there's a lot of speculation now, you know, who is she going to pick for vice president? And you dangle the idea of Elizabeth Warren basically saying, you know, just go for it, girl.
Yeah. I mean, hell, I certainly love it. I don't think that carries much weight, what Rebecca Fraser wants in politics hasn't right. always really come to pass. But there are problems with nominating Elizabeth Warren. As, you know, this right. has been covered in the past. I mean, sure. even just take away anybody's desire. You know, she's in a state with a Republican governor. There is no way that the risk of losing the Senate makes sense. There are apparently ways to get around it. They sound very complicated. You know, I think it would be a terrific idea. I think already you can see the ways I report in the piece that it's that the campaigns that Hillary's campaign and the Warren camp have increased their communication recently. There was one day where there was what felt a lot like a coordinated attack on Donald Trump. Obviously, Warren on Twitter has been waging the good Twitter fight against Donald Trump for several weeks now. You can really see how those two women acting in tandem could make a pretty phenomenal presidential team. But I think they can also work together as a team should Hillary Clinton get the presidency and Elizabeth Warren continue to have so much force in the Senate. I think we're going to, I would hope that we're going to see some of that working in tandem as leaders of the party, no matter what their, you know, presidential ticket configuration might be. It's a big risk. Hillary Clinton is not known for taking big strategic risks. And putting two women on a ticket, I mean, again, 240 years, this is the first woman we have ever nominated for either for the presidency, you know, in a major party. Putting a second woman on the ticket, that is taking a big flyer. I think it's worth it. I think it would be terrific. I think it would be energizing. I think it would help unite because Elizabeth Warren stands for some of the left economic policies that Bernie Sanders supporters feel so strongly about. I think it would be a terrific way of uniting the party. I also think, you know, it may be unlikely. There are certainly other people who I sure. know that sure. she would be considering. But it's a fun idea. I think it'd be thrilling. I think it would energize everybody. I think it'd be exciting.
Rebecca, about a minute before it's to say goodbye, just I'd be curious about your comments about Bernie Sanders and the campaign that he has run for the Democratic nomination.
Well, I love Bernie Sanders' politics, and I love his campaign, and I love that he pushed Hillary Clinton to the left. As somebody whose politics are very much the left, I'm very grateful to him, and I've been thrilled watching how much excitement he's generated and how much success he's had. I think it's thrilling that we can live in a time where socialism and democratic socialism and has become so popular and can start a movement. And I'm thrilled. I think it's been good for the country to have such a robust fight between two such capable politicians who hold such progressive views. And you know, I feel for all of his supporters who are feeling bad today because it does seem to be quite over. But I think it's been really good for everybody involved.
On that note, Rebecca Tracer, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And we called her up because we read this piece that she had in New York Times Magazine titled, New York Magazine titled Hillary Clinton versus Herself. Rebecca Tracer, writer-at-large for New York Magazine and contributing writer for Elle, author most recently of All the Single Ladies. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can download podcasts of the show. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us, and do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.